I welcome you all here for our second day of oral argument in October. But I especially want to welcome the Wanakee High School. If the students would raise their hands. But, well, thank you for coming, and we hope that you found your materials on this case and your discussions on it, including this oral argument, helpful to you. And you will meet with me at noon right here in the courtroom. Now that the court has been introduced to you, I would like to introduce... Did I say it right?
You're
the court. I want to introduce the court to you. Thank you, Doug. To my far right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Next to her is Justice John Wilcox. To my immediate right is Justice Donald Steinmetz. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice William Babbage. And to his left, Justice Jeanine Geske. And to her left, Justice Patrick Crooks. And there's material in the foyer that tells you something about the court and about the artwork work in this room, and we hope you all will take samples. With that done, we'll now proceed to our first case this morning, 96-0866, Jane Hausman et al. Versus the St. Croix Care Center. And representing Ms. Hausman and Ms. Wright is Carol Skinner. Are you ready to proceed, Ms. Skinner?
Good morning, Justices, Counsel. I'm Carol Skinner, and I'm representing Jane Hausman and Karen Wright. I thank you for reviewing this case. I think everyone would agree that what happened in this case is wrong, and the only question is really how to fix it. It can't be right that nursing home employees who are entrusted with the care of vulnerable adults could be fired for reporting to state officials when these vulnerable adults are being neglected or abused. There's two ways to remedy the problem. One of them is to imply a private cause of action under Section 5007 of the Wisconsin statutes, and the other is to recognize a wrongful discharge in violation of public policy claim in some limited circumstances. Now, the legislature appears to be taking action regarding the problem with 5007, although there's no certainty, the efforts look promising. The employer will undoubtedly argue that they're changing the law, and therefore you can't imply a private right of action. I will argue that they're clarifying the law, and that you can. Legislative drafting those don't really answer that question, and I figure that's kind of a horse apiece argument, so I'd like to focus primarily on the public policy exception to the employment at will rule. The employment at will rule is a good thing. In a capitalist society such as ours, employers should be able to manage their workforce without undue interference. They should be able to hire and fire when they need to or want to, but not if doing so breaks the law, and not if the employer's actions are an affront to the public policies that we as a society have decided are essential to our own health, public, our own health, safety, or welfare. In other words, not if an employer is actually using the discharge power to violate public policy.
Well, what's the public policy here, Ms. Skinner?
The public policy is the protection of vulnerable adults and to protect reporters who stand up and say these people are being abused or neglected. Public policy is to protect those reporters so that more reporters stand up and report. We want these people to report. When something like this happens, if these people are told that they can be fired for reporting, who's going to report?
Yeah, I just ask a question. And that is the case, and it's later found out. And I'm asking you to correct factually, was there an investigation and there was nothing done? In other words, these allegations that there were instances of abuse in others that took place, and then there was an investigation and it was found to be that there was no action taken?
There was an investigation by the Bureau of Quality Compliance after Jane Hausman had already been fired. And not one of the four people who brought forward the concerns were even questioned by the investigator. So it's our position that that investigation was not at all thorough, didn't uncover the problems.
Let me ask that question in a little bit different hypothetical. Let's assume that you prevail and that you can't fire a person for reporting. But then you have there's an employee in another nursing home who falsely reports neglect. Would the employer be able to fire that employee if you prevail?
The problem is that you don't have the benefit of the truth. When the person comes forward, the issue here is whether we want to encourage people to come forward if they have a good faith belief that there's abuse going on. There isn't the opportunity to have the investigation and clarify everything and decide whether there actually was or wasn't abuse at the time that the employee is needed to come forward and report the problem.
Well, you added the words good faith. Now, Justice Babbage's hypothetical to you just said false, so now maybe we have to change that. He was probably going to do that to you. Do you want to go ahead?
Yeah, what if it's an intentional misrepresentation? What if the employee engages in intentional misrepresentation? Would the employer be able to terminate for intentionally misrepresenting what's going on if you prevail?
I think that they should be able to, but the important thing is that that won't happen at the initial stages.
Right.
The initial stages, we want to encourage the people to come forward. If after an investigation it becomes clear that the employee was simply doing this maliciously against the employer, then of course they should be terminated.
Okay, now what if it's not malicious, and it's down to the next step, it's not malicious, it's not an intentional misrepresentation, but you've got an employee who essentially is just sort of a troublemaker and is reporting things that simply shouldn't be reported.
I think then you have to make a determination. If there is not a good faith belief and there wasn't a good faith belief, then that person is subject to the employment at will rule and he or she should be fired.
What your standard then would be, a good faith reporting is protected.
Yes.
If this would be decided, if we were to create that, this would then go before a jury, or it would be decided in the court. And do you see any problem with employees who may be on the edge, and to protect their job, would just make some allegations or do some reporting? How do you handle that within the system?
Well, I think what you need to do is stop the chilling effect that this case now has and let these cases be decided by the fact finders, which is what our system of justice is all about. If there are people who have no good faith, those people are going to be ferreted out or should be ferreted out by the jury system or the judge.
But that's rather subjective. Good faith is sometimes difficult to find. I mean, it's something that is subjective. It's not out there. There may be, so you'll hear both sides of the story, and then it'll be up to the court to decide.
Court or the jury.
Right.
Let me put this another way, and this is maybe the concern that we're expressing, is that employees of nursing homes who may be having some employment-related problems, not getting along with a supervisor, whatever, but they're then turning to an agency and reporting some violation, giving them some job protection and an assurance that they will ultimately be able to go to trial on the issue if they are terminated, whether it was related, was an at will, it was appropriate firing, or whether it was related to this reporting, and that we're going to have lots of people reporting just to make sure to have this job assurance. And how can we balance that concern versus your very public concern that, in fact, people are not chilled from reporting valid violations?
In the sexual harassment arena, we require an employee to go to an employer and address the complaint with the employer, give the employer an opportunity to resolve the situation, and if it isn't resolved, then the sexual harassment laws kick in. I think that would work in this situation.
Is that requirement made by common law, or is that requirement a statutory or administrative requirement?
It is a statutory requirement currently. But there isn't any reason why, if you're going to protect reporting activity in this instance, you don't say that the reporting has to be initiated first with the employer, which is what happened in this case. These people didn't go to an outside agency before trying their hardest to get it resolved within the facility, and it just simply didn't happen. after that, when that wasn't successful, going to a state agency is the conduct that really needs to be protected.
Bushko required that the firing can be done if the employee is ordered to do something illegal or to not do something which the law requires. Does that fit the facts of this case as to your two clients? Were they ordered to do something illegal, or were they ordered to not do something in following the law?
I guess I would answer that in two ways. I think that this could be called a refusal case just as easily as the case, the laundry case, for example. These people were required by law to take action. They are not allowed to knowingly permit others to abuse or neglect nursing home patients. To do nothing would be violating the law. They went to the employer, reported their concerns. The employer did nothing, and did nothing, and did nothing. That's an implication that the employees are being asked to do nothing themselves. And if you need to have this be a refusal case, I think it can be a refusal case. I guess, in my opinion, Bushko, because it seemingly doesn't address the facts on all fours in this case, needs to be expanded in a limited way. And the limited way that I would see expanding the employment, the public policy discharge exception would be when an employee is fired or otherwise retaliated against for doing something he or she is required by law to do, such as a doctor who sees a bruised child in his examining room, he's required to report his suspicions of abuse. Can you fire that person for doing what he's required to do? Of course not. We don't want to do that. This case, these people were required by law to take the action that they did. We don't want to fire them for doing that because they were required to do it. This isn't praiseworthy conduct. This is conduct that's required by law, by statute, ordinance, or licensing requirements. When an employee steps up to the plate and does what he or she is required to do, they oughtn't to be fired for that. Another example is when...
I'm sorry, Ms. Skinner, you were going to tell us how we are going to... deal with the Bushko case. So what would if you were going to write the opinion, what would you say?
I would say that the public policy exception to the employment at will rule includes situations where the violation or the firing itself violates the law. Whether or not an employee is asked to break the law, when the firing itself breaks the law, as it did here, that will be protected. That will be an exception to the employment at will rule.
Well, isn't the employer in a case like this implicitly telling the employee to break the law by firing them, or at least holding out the threat of firing? Isn't the employer saying, don't report or you will be fired?
Yes. I think that he is saying that, just as it has happened in laundry, the refusal came with the firing. There's other more clear-cut cases of refusal than this case or than laundry, but I think that if you needed to put this case under the Bushko analysis, it could be so put. My concern is that there are cases out there, this isn't the only one, where a person is fired and it's an obvious violation of public policy, and if it doesn't fit into the exact standards of Bushko, then these people aren't being protected, and that's what I think is the problem.
Could you give us some example of what you're referring to?
Well,
I don't mean to tell us about a specific case, but just generically, what are these other kinds of cases that fit between the facts in this case and Bushko that you're referring to?
Well, what happens when an employer reports a public transit safety issue, for example, and gets fired for that? He wasn't asked to violate the law by the employer, but if that line worker in Boeing isn't pulling off defective parts because he or she is afraid of getting fired, the public is going to suffer from that because the airplanes aren't going to be safe. Similarly with meatpacking industries or food handling industries, if a person is aware that the employer is violating the law by not adhering to sanitation standards, E. coli is the result, and that's something that we as a public don't want and we can't afford to have. And if these people are not going to be protected for reporting illegal conduct that threatens the public health, safety, or welfare, then they're not going to report them because a lot of people can't afford to lose their jobs.
What you're describing to us is pure and simple. Whistleblowing. And whistleblowing has been refused by this court. It's been refused by the United States Supreme Court also. But the examples you just gave seem to be whistleblowing. Now, there are other ways of
accomplishing a net result there that you're looking for. Union contracts, giving protection, the state through legislation. You're reporting to or making exceptions as to certain crucial employment that are to be protected. Yeah. But otherwise, it's whistleblowing.
And you don't have to go that far in this case, do you?
No, I don't.
You've got a statute that says thou shalt report.
That's true.
You've got a statute that says thou shalt, if you fire in retaliation, thou shalt be punished, employer, right?
That's correct.
So you've got clear public policy requiring reporting, number one. And number two, saying that if there's a retaliation for the reporting, the employer is going to be punished, right? What's the punishment?
Punishment is $1,000 fine or up to six months in prison.
That's criminal.
That's criminal.
You've got a criminal prosecution here. That's public policy, right?
Yes, it is, right.
By statute.
Yes.
Right? And so you've got stated public policy. Now you've got, I assume here, and I'm going to ask this to opposing counsel, let us assume for purposes of this motion to dismiss, this was a retaliatory firing.
Yes. So
it seems to me your argument is really a very narrow one, that if the employee, which you stated, when the employee retaliates, when there's retaliation against an employee for the employee doing something required by statute, there is a wrongful discharge.
I agree. And the whistleblowing,
I don't know that that's my position, but I think it's yours.
Yes, that is my position. And I only bring up the third because I think that it's something that the court should consider. But in this case, we do have a law that says the employer can't do what it did. That's public policy. We do have a law that says the employees have to do what they did. That's public policy. And I guess
I want to get down to the weakness that I see in your argument now that I've led you to that. When was there a direction to the employee to not report, or when was there a threat to the employee that if they reported, they were going to be fired?
I don't think there was an overt threat. I think that was implied when they had two or three meetings with the administrator and they got the board of directors of the facility involved and still nothing was done. I think the implication was that we're not going to do anything and we're the boss here. And soon thereafter, these two individuals did contact the state agencies and they both were fired.
I can understand that vis-a-vis second, third, fourth, or fifth employee that hypothetically might be fired. If you fire the first one for reporting, the subsequent employees, the remaining employees, can read the writing on the wall. You better not do it, you'll get fired. But how does there exist in this fact situation an implied threat of firing with regard to housing?
Well, I think that the employer was certainly aware of the statute requiring housing and right to report or to do something. And the fact that the employer itself did nothing while aware of the fact that the employees were under obligation by law to do something, that's where the implied firing comes in.
Isn't the implication just as viable when you say the implication is you tell your employer and your employer will do nothing? Why is it necessarily an implication that you'll get fired? I don't understand that in your argument.
Well, the employees are then faced with the prospect of either doing what they know the employer doesn't want done because the employer would have done it themselves. So they're going to lose their job if they do what the employer doesn't want done, or they're going to face possible prosecution for a Class E felony. That's what position we don't want to put employees in.
Ms. Skinner, let me ask you about the Ross case. It's my understanding in this particular situation, there are remedies or sanctions. There's a criminal penalty that you've talked about under 50.07. There's also 4690, which allows you to file a complaint. How do you get around the Ross case? You've got exclusive remedies, do you not?
No, we don't.
Tell me why not.
4690 protects only those employees who reported to a county agency. Our employees did not report to that county agency, therefore they are not protected by 4690.
Well, you brought an action claiming that, and that action was dismissed. Is that not correct?
That's right, because we didn't report to the county agency.
What about 50.07?
50.07 provides for criminal penalties against the employer, and that is not a remedy. A remedy is not the same thing as a penalty. If you're going to limit what happens to an employer who violates the law to getting a fine or 6 months in jail, that doesn't do anything for the aggrieved employee. That doesn't provide any remedy at all to the aggrieved employee, and therefore I don't think there's an exclusivity problem because there is no remedy provided by 5007 unless this court implies a remedy.
But the people in the rest home might be better off if, in fact, the employer is criminally charged. Things will get done then.
Well, if there's any employees left to work there, if the employees are going to lose their job and the only thing that's going to happen is the employer, after the fact, is going to be slapped with a fine, what kind of employee is going to step forward?
Yeah, but you won't lose all of your employees because somebody is a whistleblower.
But the problem is the employees see the employee who whistleblows get fired, and the next person says, "Boy, I'm not going to be able to do that. I guess I'm just going to have to let old Mrs. So-and-so, you know, get neglected."
So you don't feel that a criminal sanction would, in the long run, be the remedy that would be the best remedy? But you're saying that the employer would not be... feel threatened or coerced by a criminal penalty, one that I think not only has a fine, but has other sanctions also.
Well, I think that it's a penalty and it is not a remedy. I would hope that the employer would be dissuaded, but I think that the message being sent to the employees is the wrong one. If you say all that's going to happen is you're going to be out of a job, but the employer is going to get fined. So, you know, you did what was right.
No, not only fined, he may lose his license to operate the home. So he's out of business, so we don't have to worry about that bad apple.
Counsel, your response to Justice Crooks, that there's how you distinguish Ross, is there's a distinction between penalty and remedy. Yet Ross, at 528, seems to group them together. It says, but if such right was created, we must look to the statute to see if the remedy or penalty for a violation is provided. Now, I'm taking that out of context, so I'm not sure that that accurately reflects Ross. But it's my concern that it does, and that Ross makes no distinction between remedy or penalty by that language.
And that may depend on what the remedy and the penalty is in the specific situation. I think that this court would agree that what you have to look at in determining whether to imply a private right of action is whether the statute is designed for the public in general or whether it's designed for a specific individual that's injured by the violation of the statute. And here we have a statute that says you can't fire employees for going to a state agency, and these employees were fired for going to a state agency. Clearly, this statute was designed to benefit the people who were injured by its violation. And therefore, I think that you have the right to imply a private right of action if it makes sense. And in this situation, it certainly makes sense to let employees know they can report and something's going to happen besides a minimal fine to the employer.
Ms. Skinner, Justice Babbage has a question.
Skinner, to follow up on Justice Abrahamson's line of questioning a couple minutes ago and Justice Bradley's following hers about, you know, what is the act here that commands you to disobey the public policy? Now, let's put this in a little bit of context. Now, Bushko requires that there be a command or a direction to the employee to disobey clearly enunciated public policy. Right?
Yes.
Now, we have a clearly enunciated public policy, certainly. That is, that they are required to report, and there's criminal penalties if they don't report, if the employer does anything, et cetera. But the problem is, what is the command to disobey public policy? And your response was the employer's failure to act. Now, I don't buy that. I mean, intuitively, I sense that you might be right, but I think there's better reason, and I can't come up with it. Why is the employer, the first time that the employer fails to act with respect to your clients, I can see that kicks in after the first firing, because everybody else has been put on notice, don't report or you're going to get fired. But as to the first employee in the line, as your clients are, what does the silence mean? I mean, it could mean go ahead and report if you want, but we haven't found anything. Or they could even articulate that. The employer could even articulate that. So I need something more than simply the employer's failure to act.
Well, I think in this case, though, the employer's failure to act, coupled with its knowledge that the employees are required to act. And if they know that the employee is required to act and continue to do nothing, it seems to me an implicit command that the employee acts at his or her own peril.
Well, suppose the employer says, you know, I've checked into your complaints, we've looked at this for a week, we brought in an outside consultant, and they've looked into it, you know, we're really trying to do the right thing, and after all this, we can understand why you reached your conclusion, but we are persuaded everything's okay. Therefore, we are not going to take any further action. Right?
Yep.
I think that if you...
That's the problem. I'm trying to spell it out.
Well, I think that if you make the exception indicate that a person must come forward to the employer first and try to work things out, in this situation, what was happening was simply a blank wall, nothing was being done. They weren't saying, well, we've worked it out and everything is hunky-dory. They simply didn't address it at all and then summarily fired these people.
So you view this discussion that we're having as a factual basis that would have to be shown at trial?
I do, and I think that the judges and the courts of this state are capable of ferreting out those things.
Okay, Ms. Skinner, you will have time for rebuttal. Representing the St. Croix Care Center, Inc. is Catherine Williams. Ms. Williams?
Yes, Your Honor. Can you hear me?
You're fine.
Okay. May it please the Court, I'm Catherine Williams, attorney for Respondent St. Croix Healthcare Center. Sitting next to me is Marie Maloney from our firm. I apologize for having to sit down today, but I am recovering from knee surgery, which is why I am seated before you today. We're in a difficult position in this case, because on a motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted, as you are well aware, you have to presume that the facts as alleged in the complaint are true. And St. Croix Care Center not only denies that these women were discharged because they made reports to the state. St. Croix Care Center isn't, our position I think is clear in our briefs, that we're not defending the right of nursing home employers in the state of Wisconsin to discharge with impunity employees who make reports to state officials. In this case, the issue is simply whether or not these two women have stated a cause of action. And there is no cause of action under 50.07. There's no private cause of action for employees. There is a private cause of action under Chapter 54, nursing home residents. Significantly, there is no inclusion of a private cause of action under 50.10. for nursing home employees.
Let me just double back so I understand your position. You say you're not defending the employer's right to terminate, but I think you are. And let me just put it this way. Suppose the complaint says, which I think it does, I read it in the appendix, I am an employee of a nursing home. I reported violations. I got fired because I reported it. Now, we're on a motion to dismiss.
Right.
So we're not going to debate it. Maybe that isn't what happened. But just for purposes of being here,
right. We
have to assume it did happen.
Correct.
And therefore, and your position, if I understand it as a matter of law, your position is that if that's the allegations, you can fire an employee for reporting a violation.
Our position right now is that firing an employee in that situation is a violation of 50.07.
Right. Which brings criminal...
Correct. Which has criminal
right. Sanctions. Okay, but it does not allow for a suit for wrongful termination of an employee.
That's correct. And our position...
That's your position.
Right.
So your position is that you are defending the employer's right to terminate an employee not for criminal law purposes, but for civil law purposes of an employee bringing a lawsuit. That is your position.
It is a violation of the public policy in the state of Wisconsin for an employer
right.
to do that. And right now, there is no cause of action for an employee to bring a private remedy
right.
against the employer.
Right. So that an employer has a right to sue an employee for reporting a nursing home violation and be free from civil lawsuit on a termination of employment.
That's the law in the state of Wisconsin.
Right. That's your
today.
Position. I just want to make sure that that's your position. And the only thing that you would be liable for would be under the criminal law.
That's the current law. That's correct. Okay. And the only way the plaintiffs in this case can proceed is to either imply a cause of action under Chapter 50.07 or to expand the cause of action for wrongful discharge. My understanding is that the plaintiffs are proceeding or pleading in the alternative. However, in this case, because the legislature has already chosen a remedy, this court said in Brockmeyer, where there is the legislature has recognized a remedy or a cause of action for wrongful discharge and provided for a remedy, then that remedy is exclusive.
Well, I have a question about that. You have battery statutes that are criminal law, and they provide for a remedy, which is probably a fine and imprisonment, yet you can bring a cause of action for tort. Why isn't that exclusive?
For which statutes? I'm sorry.
Battery. Hitting.
Okay.
If you hit somebody, you can be criminally liable. There'd be a fine and imprisonment, yet you can sue for tort. We don't say the criminal law is an exclusive remedy.
In this case, I think there is an arguable claim by the plaintiffs that employees who are indeed discharged for retaliation, in retaliation for making a complaint, perhaps should have some type of private cause of action that may be brought against the employer if they can establish that. The problem is, and our position is, it's for the legislature to amend or change the statute to provide that remedy, not for this court to expand wrongful discharge or try to imply that remedy under Chapter 50 of the Wisconsin statutes. And I think the proposed Assembly Bill 500, which we filed with this court a few weeks ago, is a clear indication that the legislature is taking on this issue, has looked at it. If I can count correctly, we've got 39 representatives and 10 senators, bipartisan support for this bill, which will give plaintiffs in the situation that allegedly occurred in this case a private cause of action,
not only
under 50, but under the other statutes involved as well.
Let me ask you about what you just said. You indicated that you believe that it was for the legislature, not for the court. Are you taking the position that the court has no authority in order to expand Bushkill to include this situation, or is it that you're just asking us not to exercise our authority to do so?
We're asking you not to expand Bushkill under the facts.
And what is the rationale under a public policy analysis for us not to expand Bushkill to cover the situation here, despite the fact the legislature may also be acting, at least vis-a-vis nursing homes?
There's two reasons why I don't think wrongful discharge is appropriate in this case. First, because there is a statutory prohibition against discharge under these circumstances. When this court recognized wrongful discharge in Brockmeyer, the court said one of the reasons it was doing so is because the legislature has not and cannot cover every type of wrongful termination that violates a clear mandate of public policy. Wrongful discharge fills in those areas the legislature hasn't covered. The legislature has covered it in this case. It's not an appropriate case for a common law wrongful discharge claim.
The legislature's covered it, but has the legislature given any remedies to an employee who was fired for those purposes?
I go back to what I stated to you before, which is that there is proposed legislation, and I
know, but we're talking vis-a-vis this case.
Vis-a-vis this case. As it stands, no, they don't have the remedy. And I think there's another whole...
Ms. Williams, let me follow through with Justice Geske's question. It's my understanding that 4690 allows for the filing of a complaint. And it's my understanding further that in this particular case, the two employees involved made their report to the state rather than to the county agency. What if they had made it to the county agency? What would be the result of their filing of the complaint?
If they had made the report to a county official under 4690, which is the Elder Abuse Reporting Act, their complaint would have gone to the Equal Rights Division of the Department of Workforce Development as complaints do for discrimination under the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act, and it would have been adjudicated under the administrative process.
What would that mean to the two employees? What would they recover, if anything?
My understanding is whatever would normally be available for a wrongful termination as provided for under the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act, which would be reinstatement, back pay, the make-whole remedies that are consistent with a wrongful termination.
So there is a remedy created by the legislature.
The legislature has recognized a remedy in 4690, a private cause of action under 4690 for employees. There is none under 50.07. It is significant, I think, that Assembly Bill 500 proposes to amend 4690 as well as 50.07 as well as 16.009, which is the enabling statute for the Older Americans Act, which requires the states to pass legislation prohibiting this conduct.
Let me ask you one follow-up question. The proposed legislation deals only with nursing home reporting. Is that right?
No, the proposed legislation, 46.90, is not limited to nursing home employees.
Elder abuse.
Right, anybody. Somebody
but
anyone who lives
related
or a friend.
It's related to elder abuse?
Right, that's right.
Would our holding be limited if we were to adopt the, at least one of the theories proposed by the petitioners here, be limited to reporting of abuse to senior citizens?
To whom? I'm sorry.
Abuse, would it be limited, as the legislation is, to when an employee is required by law to report something and then allegedly is terminated for that act, would it be limited only to the reporting of elder abuse? Our holding.
That would, I don't know what your holding would be. I don't think, my concern is if you fashion some sort of expansion of wrongful discharge, you're going to get into the whistleblowing area. And that if you're limiting it only to reporting of elder abuse, I think it's for the legislature to harmonize these three statutes and fashion an appropriate remedy.
Let me give you what I'm thinking. What I'm thinking is you are arguing that one of the reasons we should not act is that the legislature is in the process of acting. And one of the proposals out of the petitioner here is that we expand Bushko and Brockmeyer to provide that when an employee is required by law to report safety issues, and they are discharged as a result of that reporting, that is protected conduct and it gives rise to a cause of action. That is one of their arguments. My question to you is that the proposed legislation is more narrow than that, relating simply to elder abuse. There may be other statutes, and I've not gone through the books, that require employees mandatorily to report things. One example I think petitioner gave were people having to mandatorily report about child abuse. There may be others out there. And my question to you is that it seems to me that if there is an expansion of the employment at will protections under Bushko, that it wouldn't be just for elder abuse, it would be for other areas, which would be more expansive than what the proposed legislation is that you're indicating.
That is correct, and that is our concern. I think when you look at wrongful discharge, in this case, there's no allegation, as has been noted, there was any command to these employees not to report. There was no threat that they would be fired if they did report. The nursing home did not act, which we understand. The nursing home did not take any action. But there were no violations found when the state came in. So I don't think you can assume that the nursing home was ignoring something that was clearly obvious.
What about counsel indicated that when the state did come in and I asked that question, that they didn't even interview the people that allegedly had the story about what happened in this particular nursing home. So she said that this was a rather cursory investigation and they didn't touch base. Are you saying that that's not true?
Well, that's, at least to some extent, that's alleged in the complaint, and what's alleged in the complaint we have to assume is true. I am stating that I would think the nursing home would have the right to rely upon the report that it received from the state. The nursing home has no way of knowing the extent of the investigation. I don't know the extent of the investigation that was made.
But under your position, it's irrelevant. It's irrelevant.
Basically, yeah, it's irrelevant. There was no command, and there was no threat.
That's right. And even if the state came in and said, this is a really a shameful mess and we're closing you off, that would be irrelevant for your wrongful termination.
That's correct.
Perfectly, it's irrelevant, right?
Right, essentially.
You're not seriously arguing, I take it, that it's because the state has legislated criminally in the areas of battery, theft, and other areas that somehow that those criminal statutes preclude private causes of action.
And that is an issue of statutory interpretation.
Well, but we allow a tort of injury, wrongful death.
And I believe I've stated that it's our position that there is an arguable basis upon which Assembly Bill 500 has been proposed to provide these people with a cause of action.
Let me address that in just a moment, because it was probably the greatest lesson I learned in the legislature as a freshman, 1973, which seems like a long time ago, but it really wasn't. The previous year, the legislature had enacted a substantial pay raise for themselves. And when I got down there, I was confronted with two Senate bills that wiped out the pay raises, and each bill contained the signatures of a minimum of 23 or 24 of the 33 state senators. And, of course, my reaction was, well, this is really going to sail through. Well, by the end of that session, two-year session, neither bill had ever come to the floor for a vote, which, of course, taught me the lesson that having a bill is a far different thing than having a law.
I understand that. According to the Blue Book, only 21% of all the bills that have been proposed in the last 10 years are actually passed. If, however, this bill isn't passed, is that not a very strong indication of the intent of the legislature not to apply a private cause of action under 50.07?
Well, let's just, first of all, the answer to you, if you're going to ask us a question, we'll probably have seven different answers, but at least one is failure to pass is perhaps the weakest kind of legislative history. The other thing about this is the date on this is September 2, 1997, and wasn't this bill introduced because these people didn't like the Court of Appeals decision?
I'm not familiar with the circumstances of the
adoption of
this bill.
Well, I would bet that that's one of the impetus.
I am assuming that is correct.
So what you've got here is you've got the legislature saying, hey, we disagree with the way the Court of Appeals interpreted this law. Well, there are two bodies that can say that the Court of Appeals didn't interpret the rule properly. One is this one, and the other is the legislature. And the legislature can say, we didn't interpret it properly either. So I don't see why a bill that was introduced to overturn a Court of Appeals decision, which is the law of the land of this state until otherwise stated by this court, I don't see how that tells you anything about legislative intent.
If it passes, it will certainly indicate legislative intent.
If it passes, it takes it out of our, at least at the moment, out of our hands and out of the any court's hands. But if it doesn't pass, And this is now in a status we don't know if it's going to pass or not. So for the moment, doesn't mean very much.
I think it means
that 29 or whatever the number of is legislators thought the Court of Appeals was wrong.
I think the significance of this bill is that it establishes that there's three statutes here that are interrelated, that are part of a complicated federal and state regulatory scheme for licensure of nursing homes and for elderly, protection of the elderly, et cetera, and that it is for the legislature to work through this and to harmonize these three statutes and to handle it. This is a statutory issue. I mean, that's the bottom line here, is that this is a, that's our position, because the legislature should be ruling.
You admitted to me that certainly the court has authority to develop common law and public policy that plays a role in the development of common law. And the court certainly has, in past cases, gotten involved in the issue of employment at will and protected some employees and given them a cause of action when, in fact, for public policy reasons, they were terminated. Tell me why, when an employee is required by law to report an issue involving one, certainly a public policy and public safety, and they allegedly are discharged for that reporting, why they should not be able to have a cause of action to maintain their employment.
Okay, this goes to the difference between the scenario that is established and recognized as wrongful discharge under Bachman and Bushko and the subsequent cases, where the employer actually commands the employee to do or not do something or threatens the employee if they do or don't violate the public policy or follow the law. You are given, by that conduct, you have an indicia of the employer's position and intent vis-a-vis that public policy. When the employee goes ahead and does it or doesn't do it or disobeys or ignores the employer, you have an indicia of the good faith of the employee in their conduct. With an indicia of where the employer stands, which in the good faith is a very crucial issue here, now you have a nexus to the subsequent discharge. You have a reason to believe and to give that employee the right to go into court and to make a claim that they were wrongfully discharged. You don't have that where the employee sua sponte elects to engage in conduct, whether it's required by law or simply praiseworthy or inconsistent with the law. If they choose to make a report or on their employer, the employer may or may not know about it. You have no indicia. The employer says nothing, does nothing, doesn't threaten. You have no indication of what the employer is thinking or what their position is vis-a-vis the policy. You have clear problems of the good faith of the employee. As you indicated earlier in your questioning of opposing counsel, there's no protection here for the disgruntled employees and the unhappy employees and the employees who are facing discipline whose jobs may be in jeopardy. So you don't have the good indicia of good faith, you don't have the indicia of the intent of the employer, and there's no nexus to the discharge.
Of course, the criminal statute doesn't give that protection to the employer either, does it? The criminal 50.07 does not require good faith. It simply says you can't fire retaliatory or reporting.
Right.
That's correct.
That's to be compared to the other statute in the 40s that does.
46.90 requires good faith.
But not the one we're under.
Right. I find that very. I'm a great concern even in the Semmelweis 500, which is in its infancy, but there's good faith in 4690. It's not included in 1609. It's not in 50.07. I don't understand that.
No, but we are operating under 50.07. In this.
That's correct, and it's not included in there. That's correct.
Are you finished with that answer?
I think I answered your question.
I want to follow up on one of Justice Geske's earlier questions. Seems to be your position that Assembly Bill 500, which deals with those involved with elder care, it's your position let the legislature handle it in not the courts. Yet I look at the Brockmeyer case that involved a trainee analyst at Dun & Bradstreet. And we did not limit our holding in Brockmeyer to trainee analysts. In the Bushko case, we addressed a wrongful discharge in the context of a warehouse supervisor at Miller Brewing Company, but we didn't limit our holding to warehouse supervisors. As we examine this case, which involves an employee engaged in elder care, why should we limit our examination to only those involved in elder care as the legislation narrowly addresses?
I'm not suggesting that you do limit your holding.
I thought by your argument that we defer to the legislature, because here we have Act 500, Assembly Bill 500,
correct,
that deals only with elder care. So
that's
you're saying, court, don't address this issue that's before us in this case today, because we have something that's already addressing it. But I submit to you, if we took that narrow response, we would only be addressing warehouse supervisors in Bushko and trainee analysts in Dun & Bradstreet.
if the court, we're not asking the court to limit its decision on wrongful discharge to only those situations that involve reporting concerning the care and treatment of the elderly in Wisconsin. That's a broad, any decision this court issues on wrongful discharge, it's my understanding it would cover any and all employers in the state and any and all whistleblower situations that may arise under any laws and public policies of the state of Wisconsin.
Well, not if you say that the public policy is in 50.07, and that's what the whole thing hangs on, then it covers just people that are covered by 50.07.
That's correct. You're looking at the public. Well, that's acknowledged. We acknowledge the public policy. Mm-hmm. But there's a public policy in a lot of other statutes for reporting, as opposing counsel indicated, for reporting on waste disposal and a lot of other statutes. I'm not that familiar with them. But, no, any decision that's made on wrongful discharge, as you well know, has far-reaching consequences and could not be limited simply to the facts in the situation presented by this case.
Well, why don't you think we can say that under 50.07 that the legislature has not prohibited civil action? Why can't we get off the employment scene and say unwrongful discharge and say that 50.07 is silent on a civil action, right?
50.07 is silent on a private cause of action, but Chapter 50 is not. 50.10 does give a private cause of action under that chapter.
To the residents.
10 is limited to nursing home residents.
Right.
That was enacted after 50.11 and 50.07. And absent any other legislative history, which I was unable to uncover, I think that shows an intent of the legislature, if they wanted to put a private cause of action in for nursing home employees, they could have done so when they enacted 50.10, when they gave the private cause of action to nursing home residents.
Well, Chapter 50 is a licensing statute.
That's correct.
And I would assume, I think I read the policy sections of this, I assume that this whole focus in 50 is towards benefit of the residents.
Yes, it's to ensure that nursing homes meet certain standards in order to obtain and then to maintain their licensure.
Right, so you would not necessarily expect in a chapter in the statute book entitled Uniform Licensure, etc., that we deal with employment except as it affects the nursing home residents. So I think you can make an argument, I don't know how persuasive it is, that that statute wouldn't be touching wrongful discharge.
50.07 is a listing of 5, 6 different prohibited acts that a nursing home is not permitted to engage in, which would interfere with the regulatory process, the inspection process, the survey process. They need to ensure that nursing homes open their books and show the inspectors and the surveyors what's going on, answer the questions, don't hide things, don't destroy things, let the residents talk, let the employees talk, etc. And the last one, or the second to last one on there is a prohibition then against interfering with residents or employees. It covers residents as well as employees. It is not specifically focused, no, as an employment chapter or as a chapter that is addressing concerns of nursing home employees. It's there to regulate the nursing homes, which is ostensibly why a penalty was chosen by the legislature when it enacted Section 50.07(2), a criminal penalty, as opposed to private causes of action.
Let me take this out of the arena. I was trying to think of other examples, and I'm having a hard time. When you do that, you often bring yourself into your own experience. And what I was thinking of is lawyers have, and it's not by law, but it's at least by code of ethics, responsibilities of reporting, reporting on ethical behavior by other lawyers. I don't know what doctors have in terms of medical requirements, but it's a requirement of the profession, it's a requirement of licensure. What if, and let's just take a lawyer, and let's assume that the ethical code of the law as opposed to a rule of this court, a lawyer in a law firm reports the unethical behavior of another lawyer within the firm, and is fired because he or she has done that, and that lawyer is an employee at will. Your position is there should be no cause of action for that employee against that law firm for following what he or she is mandated to do. Is that right?
There isn't a cause of action currently as the wrongful discharge cause of action is recognized in Wisconsin.
So the answer is there is no cause of action?
That's correct.
Is that good public policy?
Well, what is this court going to do? Piecemeal and take each situation as it comes to it and decide if they're going to recognize wrongful discharge in this situation or under these circumstances or in this industry or in this... I think that's a very difficult way to approach it. You either have to open it up to that or you have to keep the narrow limitation where you have the protections. I mean, you're assuming... Saying someone has a cause of action is different than saying that... You're assuming in all of these circumstances that the employer is guilty and that's the reason the person...
Well, we have to do that for purposes of whether a cause of action exists.
Yeah,
whether or not that is the justification and there are other reasons.
It's whether or not they should have their day in court is really
that's
what
right.
I'm saying. Yeah.
Let me just ask you, as a general proposition, do you think it's right for an employer to fire an employee for reporting, for doing what the law commands them to do? Just as a general proposition, let's get it out of the law.
No. I'm sorry. I can continue, but the time is up if you want.
You can continue.
What? If the law requires an employee to take some action, and the employee takes that action and is subsequently discharged somewhere down the line, there still has to be some sort of a nexus between their taking that action and the discharge for them to be able to come into court. And not just an administrative agency, which is where all of these other cases go, is before administrative agencies, but to come into court and bring a claim for wrongful discharge.
I'm assuming that there is a nexus.
But you have to go to
question that my question is, assumes that there is no question that the employee was fired for doing what the law commanded that employee to do.
Well, then what you're telling me is that the requirements for wrongful discharge as it stands now have been met. That there was somehow there was some sort of order not to do it and the report was made and that there's clear evidence that this is the reason, then the employer should not be able to discharge and that would be covered under the current wrongful discharge law. That would be my understanding.
And that reporting is supposed to be to a county agency. Isn't it county agency to report to the county, or is it report to the state?
You can report to either. My understanding is that if a report is made to the county agency, it ends up before the state eventually. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Skinner, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you. I just want to comment about this idea of whether or not an employer hires an employee for doing what he's required to do is acting within or without the law, and whether that's right or wrong. Right now, unless the employer commands the employee not to report, then there is no protection for the employee who reports. And that's the problem. Bush Cole, I understand the reasoning in Bush Cole, and I understand the importance of keeping an employment at will as the rule. But when you have a situation where an employee is required by law, whether it's statute, ordinance, licensing requirements, to report or to take an action, that is a violation of public policy to fire him or her for doing exactly what he or she is required to do. And that is where Bush Cove needs to be refined or simply maybe explained. Even if there's not a direct command, if the employer is doing what he or she must do, you can't fire them for that. You can't allow the employer to use the discharge policy or the employment at will policy as a club. Again, We have to look at what we're trying to accomplish with the wrongful discharge exception. We want these people to be reporting conduct that threatens our safety, health, or welfare. And if we don't protect them, they're not going to report that kind of conduct, and we as a society will suffer for that. Running your business on your own is one thing, but threatening public welfare is quite another.
Now, this is a private nursing home, right?
Yes.
It's not a state.
That's correct. It's private.
County run. It's a private nursing home.
Okay. The other thing I wanted to add is that in terms of implying a private right of action under 5007, the Yanta court decision is instructive in this instance. In Yanta, the situation was an employee was fired, and at that time the statutes did not provide for back pay. So there was found to be a wrongful discharge, but the only remedy was reinstatement. There was no back pay, and therefore the court looked at whether or not the statute that was in question was designed to protect the public or an individual person, and they found that the individual person was the target of protection. They also found that the legislature had indicated an intent to provide back pay, and therefore the court provided the back pay, even though it wasn't explicitly contained in the statute. Here we have pretty much the same situation. We have the legislature who has taken action because of the Hausman case, so we know what the legislature's intent is, at least many of the representatives.
Counsel.
So in my opinion, that's a situation where private right of action could be implied. The statute is silent about private cause of action for employees. I'm sorry.
Counsel, you mentioned the Yanta case, and I get back to the Ross problem. Yanta cites Ross